concrete walls of the garage echo with the clanging of metal on metal. The tinny sounds are ensconced in the room and don't bleed through into the house. It's a good thing, because he wants them to remain in deep sleep. Soon, the dawn light will start to filter through the windows. And so he knows the time has come. His work is done, and there's no going back now. He stands, grabs the gun, and starts toward the door. On the other side, things will never be the same again. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 195, The Dupria Family Murders. This episode is sponsored by the upcoming release movie, Coyotes. I think we all need something a little less serious in our lives right now. Coyotes is technically in the horror genre, but it's actually also a comedy. Married couple Liv and Scott, along with their teenage daughter Chloe, are about to have the night of their lives, and not in a good way. As a wildfire rages in their suburb of the Hollywood Hills, nature has started to make alternate arrangements for the furry inhabitants of the fire-ravaged area. The coyotes are moving into town, and they, perhaps understandably, feel like the area would be much nicer for their pack if it were a little less populated. So they're taking out the humans, one by one, sometimes two by two. Liv and Scott, played by real-life couple Kate Bosworth and Justin Long, must now try to survive the night and try to take back their neighborhood as they watch their neighbors, including Playboy Tripp and his paid-for girlfriend for the night, get decimated by the coyotes. Directed by Colin Minahan and also starring Brittany Allen and Norbert Butts, Coyotes is jump-scare hilarity at its best and opens in cinemas across South Africa next Friday, the 14th of November. I have three double tickets to give away to three lucky True Crime South Africa listeners. So quickly pause this podcast, head over to any of the podcast socials, and enter now. If you would like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. True Crime South Africa has partnered up with the South African Criminologist platform. And if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you will get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za and support the podcast while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Zelda Brits, Christine Ulvatni, Sam D'Araja, Tamsin and Jethro, Glynis Chu, Teboho Zebalani, Leanne Williams, and Helga Schmidt for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Sometimes when I think about relationships and how they can degenerate into violence, I feel like it often starts with a boundary-testing disrespect. Very often, abusive partners will accuse their victims of infidelity, when in reality, it's them who is having the affair. Whether or not that's them feeling like the rules don't apply to them, or if it's just mind tricks and manipulation to distract from what they're doing, this can be a point at which a relationship can go one way or another. Of course, there are occasions where someone may cheat on their partner once and never do it again. But a lot of the time, especially when this is paired with financial or emotional abuse, if that behavior is accepted once without repercussions, it's going to happen again. Even after multiple instances of infidelity, though, it's still an enormous stretch for anyone to think that that person would end up killing their partner, and even more of a bridge too far, their children. The disrespect of cheating is one thing, but the savagery of wiping out your entire family is quite another, right? Or maybe, for some people, it might just be a continuum. Either way, although we should always respect ourselves enough to not tolerate repeated poor treatment, the fault always lays with the person repeating the behavior. In today's case, a man started out disrespecting his family and ended up taking their lives. What some might have seen as typical Casanova behavior degenerated into a horrific, greedy bloodlust. In researching this case, I used an episode of Heiskenoot Ware Levensdramas, Vlees en Bloed, several traditional media sources, and several social media sources. So, let's get into episode 195, The Dupreer Family Murders.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Tia and Fanny Dupreer met quite by chance in 1996. Fanny had been dropping off Tia's sister, who was dating Fanny's friend at that time, and they were late getting back, so Fanny had come inside to apologize to her parents. That is when the lovely brunette Tia, who looks so similar to her two sisters, Rihanna and Rina, first set eyes on the handsome blue-eyed man. She would later say that it was those blue eyes that had pulled her in. And when Fanny returned the following week to ask her out on a date, she'd quickly agreed. Their romance was fast and fiery, and within a year, they were married. By 1998, they'd welcomed their first child, a girl they named Kalia. Genetics clearly run very strongly among Tia's side of the family, because all the female children born to her and her sisters look very similar. All beautiful girls with chestnut hair and olive skin. Tia's sisters are also clearly very closely bonded. Rihanna and Rina spoke about their sister in the Vlees en Bloed episode, and it's very evident that the women remain very close, even after they had all married and started their own families. On Fanny's end, things are a little less clear. There's very little information in the public domain about his childhood, but we do know that his mother was no longer with his biological father and had remarried. Fanny seemed to have a decent enough relationship with his mother and stepfather, though, because the older couple would end up moving in with Tia and Fanny and living on their property in Funderbale Park, in a granny flat at the back. A comment Fanny's mother would make much later points to there having been significant tragedy in the family over the years. The woman mentioned that four of her children had died, and although we have no detail around that, that level of loss for a mother is, of course, horrendous to imagine. The idea of Tia being the stable, grounded one, and Fani being the one who always seemingly treaded water and was experiencing difficulty, would continue on through the couple's relationship. 3 years after Kalia was born, Tia gave birth to a boy they named Philip. Throughout their marriage, Tia worked full-time, cared for the children, and ran the household. Most, if not all, of the money that came into the household came from Tia. Fani had never really settled into an actual career or stable job. He struggled to work for a boss and regularly just did casual work. At one point, hoping he might enjoy security work and find some stability, Tia had paid to send her husband on a course to become a qualified security guard. But even after this, Fani floated from job to job regularly. Despite his seeming inability to stay employed for any length of time, Fani was well-liked by most people, and many said he always went out of his way to help. As the children in the extended family grew up, he would often be the one that they would call on for help with technical projects or if their friends' cars broke down. Fani seemed to very much enjoy being one of the boys, so to speak, and he frequently spent far more time with the younger members of the family than those in his own age group. While the cousins all called Tia Auntie Tia, Fani insisted on just being called Fani and not Uncle. We don't know for sure exactly how many times Fani strayed from his marriage, but Tia's sisters had practically lost count of the number of times she told them that she'd caught him cheating again. Each time, Tia would threaten to divorce him, and he would seem to have an emotional meltdown, beg for her forgiveness, and promise he'd never do it again. And Tia would relent and set out on the long road to repairing their marriage, only for the same thing to happen a few years, or sometimes only months later. It was devastating for her sisters to watch, but they knew that they had to support her in her decisions, or it would only make things more difficult for her. Although the younger members of the extended family didn't really seem to notice, Tia's sisters said that as the children grew up, it seemed as though Fani was just living with his wife and children, and not truly part of the family unit. He was physically present, but emotionally, somewhere else. According to several family members, Fani was not particularly fond of his son, Philip. The boy was quite a sensitive young man, emotionally intelligent, and enjoyed pastimes that his father didn't think were appropriate for boys, like different forms of dance. Fani seemed to be on a constant mission to toughen his son up and turn him into what he perhaps saw as the type of son he should have. Where Kalia was concerned, when she was younger, she seemed to be the apple of her father's eye. But it was clear from a young age that she had a very strong personality, and it wasn't long before she and her father were clashing. As much as Tia tried to keep Fani's infidelity from her children, not wanting to poison their image of their father, as children do, they soon figured out what was going on, and Kalia was disgusted in her father. She regularly voiced her opinion around his affairs, and father and daughter were rarely on good terms as Kalia became a teenager. Tia did her best to ensure the children had a peaceful home life, and they both excelled at school and in their hobbies and activities. In the afternoons after school, Kalia and Philip were looked after by their grandmother, as were many of their cousins, so the bonds between the children were far stronger than would usually be the case if they were only seeing each other at occasional family gatherings. Where it came to the difficulties between their parents, the children kept that to themselves for the most part, but Kalia would share with those close with her that she could no longer respect her father when she thought about all the times he'd betrayed her mother and broken her heart. By 2015, Kalia was 17 and Philip was 14. They were both at Hoërskool Driehoek, and Kalia was dating a boy she'd been seeing for a few years. Behind the scenes around this time, Tia once again discovered that her husband was cheating on her. Only this time, she realized that the relationship seemed to be very different to his previous ones. Ordinarily, Fani would jump between women. But by the time Tia discovered this affair, he'd already been seeing the woman for quite some time, and their messages had a very different tone to the others. Tia confronted Fani about the affair, and he, as always, broke down and apologized and promised to end it so that they could work on their relationship. With a feeling that this affair was more serious than the others, Tia had even gone to confront the woman Fani was seeing at her workplace. Tia had taken her sister with her for moral support, and her sister tells the Heiskanoot production team that the meeting ended up being very different than what they'd expected. Fani's affair partner had left work and invited the women to her home so they could talk. Tia had told her that she and Fani were committed to working on their marriage, and she begged the woman to stay away from him so that they could do what she thought was best for their children. The woman apparently agreed, and soon after she sent Fani a message saying that their relationship was over. In that year, Fani had started working for a construction company in Springs, and he couldn't travel home every night because it was simply too far, so he would stay in Springs during the week and come home on weekends. This only served to increase the distance between him and Tia, and it seemed impossible for them to work on their marriage this way. Understandably, Tia did not really trust Fani to be faithful while he was away from home, and tensions started to grow in the relationship. Several people would later say that Tia had reached her breaking point and told Fani that she wanted a divorce. She was also looking into selling the home they lived in so they could split the proceeds and move on separately. Then Fani got the news that he'd been let go from his job. There's no information about why this happened, but he was apparently expecting a payout of 27,000 rand when he left. And he decided that he was going to use the money to start a business, a very specific type of business, selling BDSM apparel. In case you don't know what that term means, it's an area of sexual interest and fetish involving bondage and discipline, domination and submission, and sadism and masochism. The type of apparel Fani's dream business was going to sell would include the types of items used in these acts. Now, this isn't really a business you decide to open on a whim if you have no connection with the BDSM scene. And understandably, Tia and Fani's intimate life had suffered a lot from his multiple affairs. So clearly, Fani had been engaging in these interests with other people. It would later emerge that the woman he had been seeing in the longer-term extramarital relationship was related to someone who owned what they would only describe as a club. Possibly, I guess, an establishment that perhaps, among other types of parties, also hosted BDSM gatherings. But that's entirely speculation. Either way, Fani was sold on this being a brilliant business idea, and Tia likely saw this as yet another reason that she should definitely be divorcing her husband. But 27,000 rand doesn't stretch very far when you're opening a business, and Fani had to be well aware that he was about to be in a very precarious financial position. Throughout their marriage, Tia had paid for pretty much everything. And if she divorced him and the business idea didn't work, he would be in serious trouble. Those around Fani said that by November 2015, he was behaving out of character. He was very reserved, and when the family went camping toward the end of November with Tia's sisters and their families, he declined to participate in any of the group activities and spent the entire weekend sleeping under a tree. The family had another holiday planned in December. Every year at the same time, the whole family went to Umhlanga in KZN. Tia budgeted for it in January and would pay the amount off throughout the year so that they could have a break in one of their favourite spots every year. The children loved spending time at the beach, and Kalia's social media is dotted with several sets of these trip photographs, with the family eating ice cream on the beach and playing in the surf. Sadly, although Tia had already diligently paid off their trip for that year, and everyone was looking forward to their annual trip to the beach, there would be no more coastal holidays for the Dupria family. Fani was about to make sure of that. On the evening of the 2nd of December, Kalia's boyfriend Brandon had visited the Dupria home, as he usually did. He recalled how he'd teased Kalia and they'd laughed together as she had a beauty mask on, which had hardened and she couldn't move her face at all. He kissed her goodnight and told her he'd see her the next day. He hadn't been aware that anything was brewing in the house that night. But Fani's mother would say that she'd heard Fani and Tia arguing about the sale of the house. Tia seemed set on the divorce now, apparently having come to the realization that her husband was never going to change his philandering ways. As the family settled in for the night, one member did not go to bed. While Tia, Kalia and Philip got into bed and fell asleep, Fani went into the garage. There he began working on an idea he had. It involved an old oil filter from his car, some modifications to it, a lot of masking tape, and three guns. Eventually, it would involve a pillow too, just to be sure. As the Dupria family slept, Fani continued on with his work in the garage. His mother would later say that she'd been disturbed by the argument she'd heard between her son and his wife that night and had battled to sleep. So just after 4 a.m. the next morning, when a loud popping sound ripped into her subconscious, she was immediately wide awake. She lay for a moment, wondering what it was she'd just heard, and then woke her husband, telling him that she thought she may have just heard gunshots somewhere. As her husband struggled to clear himself of the blur of sleep, there was a loud hammering on the door of their cottage. It was around 4:30 a.m., and suddenly Fani's voice filled the air. "Wake up," he shouted. "There's a big fuck-up in the house." Over the next few minutes, chaos ensued at the home in Funderbale Park. Fani's mother and her husband came to understand that Tia, Kalia, and Philip had been shot. The woman would later say that her son had told her that the drug lords were here. She'd been confused. She'd never known her son to be involved with drugs. But everything had happened so quickly she didn't have time to question him further, and soon the paramedics and police her husband had called arrived at the house. The first officers on the scene that morning were taken into the house by Fani Dupria. They were accompanied by paramedics, although Fani told them that his family were beyond saving. And sadly, he was correct. Tia, Kalia and Philip Dupria were all dead. Tia was found in her bed. She was still covered with her duvet, as though she'd been shot while sleeping. By contrast, Philip was found on the floor of his bedroom, and Kalia, although on her bed, was not in a position that indicated she'd been asleep when she'd been shot. She had definitely moved around. And more horrifying details about the children's demise would emerge later. Farney told these first responding officers that he'd been in the garage working on his car that morning when he went into the house for a glass of water and was ambushed by men who'd broken into his house and discovered that they'd killed his family. This initial story already seemed odd. The alleged intruders had left their gun in the house, Farney said, and there were items they'd tried to steal but left behind in the garden as he chased them away. When the police officers checked, they found the items lined up in a perfectly straight line next to the wall leading to the neighbour's yard. Farney claimed the men had fled over that wall, but it had rained that night, and there was no sign of muddy footprints anywhere on the property. In addition, there was no forced entry into the house, and Farney couldn't explain how they had gained entry. It seemed very strange that people breaking in to steal would go out of their way to go into the bedrooms of clearly sleeping residents to kill them in their beds, and then, after killing two children, failed to also kill their father, who confronted them. The scene was closed off, and Farney was asked to leave the property and stand outside. Between him and his mother, they made most of the calls that morning to alert those close to the family of the terrible tragedy that had befallen them. Farney was not very clear with those he phoned. To Kalia's boyfriend, he simply said, "There's a big fuck-up here, my friend. There's shit at the house." Farney's mother phoned one of Tia's sisters, telling the woman, "Something has happened at the house, you must come." So, it would be huddled in groups in the still bleary light of dawn, that in whispers and sobs, those who loved Tia, Kalia and Philip would discover the horrifying truth. Tia's sister says that although she was in deep shock, she remembered being impressed with how the police were taking charge of the situation. They had a team inside the house collecting forensic evidence, and then several officers posted outside the house, whose job it was to separate each family member or friend from the group of mourners outside and try to get as much information as possible about the Dupriere family and who may have wanted them dead. After speaking with the officer assigned to her, Tia's sister watched as the officers inside the property searched the yard. They were clearly looking for something very specific. Under each plant leaf and carefully walking a grid pattern so they didn't miss anything. Through her haze of grief, she leaned into her husband and asked him if she was imagining things or if it looked like they were searching for a specific item. Her husband said it certainly looked that way to him too. They would later learn that what police were searching for was a second gun. They had found one laying on the floor of the house, a .38 Special, which Farney had said the men had dropped after they'd killed his family and while they were fleeing. But experienced ballistics experts attending the scene had immediately noticed that two guns had actually been used in the murder, the .38 Special and a 9mm, which is what they were looking for. As Tia's sister stood watching the police, something occurred to her. The garage was standing open, and officers had been moving in and out of it during the morning too. She leaned over to her husband again and asked whether he thought they'd found the trapdoor in the ceiling of the garage. They knew it was there because they had spent a lot of time in the house visiting, and there was a large area inside the ceiling that the family sometimes used to store things. Soon, the pair were calling an officer over and relaying this information. He thanked them and walked inside the garage. A quick exchange between him and the I.O. occurred, and within minutes, the crowd watched a ladder being put up and an officer opening a trapdoor, which was otherwise quite hidden from view. In the ceiling space, police found two more guns and a pair of gloves. One of the guns was a 9mm. This whole time, Fonny Dupriere had been standing with the crowd gathered outside his house. Most would say that they assumed he was in shock because he wasn't behaving in a very emotional way at all. Of course, we all experience situations like this differently, but Fonny was dry-eyed, and his only concern was gathering with the younger people in the crowd and telling them how sorry he was for their loss. Tia's sister suggested to Fonny that he come back to their house and they could have some coffee, and he could stay there as long as he needed to. Fonny shook his head, though. "Oh, no," he said. He was staying right there, and would be back in the house as soon as the police would let him. His whole life, he said, was inside that house. Soon the investigating officer came over to Fonny and asked him if he would come back to the police station with him so he could take his official statement. Fonny agreed and the pair left. It would be at the station that the second version of Fonny Dupriere's story was delivered to police. On arrival, Fonny initially gave the same story he had at the house. He had been working on his car in the garage and then gone into the house, where he was accosted by the intruders, who he then chased off, and he realized they'd killed his family. But I.O. Warrant Officer Francois Alberts was already convinced that there was far more at play here than a home invasion gone wrong. He started to question Fonny's version, telling him how certain things didn't fit what he was saying. Explaining how his family had been killed with two different guns, and one of those guns, the 9mm, was registered to him and had been found hidden in the garage he claimed to have been in the whole time that the murders were taking place. So much of this did not make sense. That was when Fonny brought the mafia into the mix. The Lebanese mafia, to be precise. He claimed that for months he'd been hounded by a Lebanese organized crime syndicate. They wanted him to be a drug courier for them, and he'd refused. And so on the morning of the murders, those men had come to his house and killed his family to punish him. And they'd taken his 9mm, and then they must have hidden it in the ceiling space without his knowledge. This new story was actually even more unbelievable than the first. Of course, it did explain more of the evidence, but it was also completely unlikely. Fonny claimed to have had no prior interactions with drug trafficking or organized crime groups. So he was essentially asking police to believe that these professional criminals had been so desperate to have Fonny Dupriere in particular courier their drugs, that they would go as far as committing a triple murder, including two children, to punish him for refusing to. Fonny was sticking to his story, though. So Albert suggested they go back to the house and do a walkthrough so he could explain exactly what had happened. There, Fonny's story began to crumble, and a third version emerged. Perhaps when he realized that police had recovered the gloves, and he knew very well, as would later be discovered, that only his DNA would be found inside those gloves, and the gloves were also covered in gunshot residue, he knew he now had to explain that evidence. And his new version would also put anyone of Lebanese heritage out of suspicion, but he inserted a new nationality. This time, Fonny said that it had been Nigerian drug dealers who had been trying to coerce him into participating in their drug business, and when he had refused, they'd arrived at his house and they had forced him to shoot his children after one of their men had shot Tia with the .38 Special, he claimed belonged to the Nigerian men. When Fani's mother had told police that she'd only heard one or two gunshots that morning, and that she hadn't been sleeping very well in general that night, they had to wonder why she wouldn't have heard the initial gunshots. A car oil filter in the dustbin, covered in masking tape, and a pillow discarded near the door of Philip's bedroom, soon answered that question. The oil filter and the pillow had traces of gunshot residue on them. A forensic search of Fani's cell phone showed that he had searched for and viewed YouTube videos which explained how to make a temporary gun silencer. The video's creator suggested using an old oil filter from a car. Earlier that evening, just 11 hours after Tia, Kalia and Philip had been shot, Fani was arrested for their murders. Understandably, as news started to spread to their friends and family members, no one could quite believe their ears. Even Tia's sisters, who had been privy to all their marital turmoil and Fani's multiple affairs, could not believe that Fani would have been capable of killing his family. But the evidence was piling up. There was no sign of anyone else having been at the house that morning. The .38 Special and the other gun, which was not registered to Fani, were traced back to their original owners, who were deceased. The guns had been sold as part of their estate, and both families identified Fani Dupriere as the person who had purchased them. Fani also could not produce any proof that he had ever been threatened by any members of an organized crime syndicate, Nigerian, Lebanese, or any other nationality for that matter. One of Fani's friends would later say that he'd mentioned to him at one stage that he was being hounded by Lebanese mafia members, and that same friend would end up paying so that Fani could have a private lawyer instead of using legal aid. But considering Fani had purchased the guns quite some time before the murders, and there were other signs that he'd been premeditating the murders of his family, it's entirely possible that this was just him planting the seeds he would later seek to reap. Even before Fani's arrest was announced, when the very first article about these murders was released, it was clear that members of the public found Fani's story very strange. The comments section is littered with people questioning why someone would be working on their car at 4 a.m. And in all fairness, that alone is not evidence of anything, because, well, people suffer with insomnia and sometimes do odd things to pass the time when they can't sleep. And if you only have one car and it breaks down and your family needs to use it the next day, then maybe you would be foregoing sleep to get it sorted. But that was not the case with the Dupriere family. And then, that same day, the next article appeared, which announced Fani's arrest. If Fani's intention in killing his family was to avoid any besmirching of his character in a divorce, he failed miserably. Because the day after his arrest, the media was already reporting how he had been unfaithful to Tia many times. By the 9th of December, a woman who described herself as a good friend of Fani's had spoken to the media and revealed something interesting and disturbing. She said that he had phoned her at 10 a.m. as the police had been busy in his house and told her that his family were dead. Fani claimed that the whole family had been involved in an argument the previous night, and Kalia and Philip had expressed to him that they no longer saw him as their father because he had cheated on their mother so many times and destroyed their family. He allegedly told the woman that he had snapped when they said this, and the implication was that this had led to the murders. This woman would really be the only person he would ever actually tell that he had shot his children, without some other external force also being involved.
I do not know whether she ever testified at trial, as she's not mentioned anywhere again. And this version would never be put forth by Fani officially as a defence either. Many of the details of exactly what had happened that morning remained under wraps until Fani's bail hearing. And disturbingly for the family, they would hear some of the most horrifying parts in court while his attorney read out his plea statement. He was initially pleading not guilty while applying for bail. He would later change that to guilty, but that would be rejected by the state because they believed he was not telling the truth when he claimed that drug dealers were involved and he'd been forced to shoot his children. The statements he gave put him as the gunman in Philip and Kalia's room, while the other individuals had shot Tia, according to him. What the statement did do is give a probably very accurate account of how the shootings had happened for the most part. Fani said that Tia had been the first to be shot. From the evidence, we know that he had his homemade silencer on the .38 special at this time, because no one heard those shots. He likely also had the pillow wrapped around the gun to further silence it. Tia was shot twice in the head. She was very likely still asleep when it happened, and would not have known what he was doing. Philip's bedroom, though, was right next door to his parents, and it appears that he had heard something. Fani claimed that after the men had shot his wife, they made him take his 9mm into Philip's room. He said that Philip had been awake and about to stand up when he had shot him, and Philip had fallen on the floor. And while the evidence would show that Philip likely had been woken up by the shots that had killed his mother, the rest went differently, and devastatingly so. The evidence would later show that the .38 special had actually been fired in Philip's room, but none of those bullets had hit him. Police believe that the makeshift silencer had made it difficult for Fani to aim, and although a sleeping target like Tia would have been easier to aim at, Philip was moving around, and so Fani had fired 3 shots, which had gone over the boy's head into the wall behind him. They also believe at this point the .38 special had jammed, and Philip may have seen his opportunity and tried to push past his dad to the door or take some other evasive action. And as a result, Fani had pulled the 9mm he had in his pockets out and fired 3 bullets at him, striking him in the head and killing him instantly. With the 9mm having no makeshift silencer and the noise of the struggle, it is very certain that Kalia had woken up. Heartbreakingly, Fani would admit that when he had entered her room and pointed the gun at his daughter, she'd shouted, "No, Daddy, no." But he had fired the 9mm at her anyway. 17-year-old Kalia was shot 6 times. The forensic pathologist would later testify that she had undoubtedly been moving around on the bed while the shots were fired at her. And 1 shot had gone through the back of her hand into her face. During the autopsy, he was able to line up the wound in her hand perfectly with the wound in her face. Kalia had been trying to shield herself from the bullets with her hand when she was killed. Perhaps also attempting to block the horror of what was her last moment. The deepest of betrayals and the most horrific of violence from her own father. Tia and the children's family members were horrified to hear this evidence presented in court. It would have been bad enough if they had been killed in their sleep. But to know that the children had been awake and tried to defend themselves, that they had known who their killer was. It was gut-wrenching to everyone who loved them. Fanny DiPrio was denied bail. The magistrate was uncharacteristically vocal about how he was amazed at how many different stories Fanny had tried to present for what had happened, and said he simply couldn't trust him to conduct himself properly while out on bail if he continued to fabricate stories. And with that, Fanny was sent back down to spend the festive season in prison, and proceedings were postponed until February the following year. Tia's family left the court that day, wondering how they would make it through their first Christmas without Tia, Kalia, and Philip. First, though, they had to lay them to rest. With the autopsies complete, the family arranged for a triple funeral to be held at a church in Vanderbijl Park. The photographs in the press from that day are haunting. It's always jarring to see photographs of large groups of young people at a funeral. It's something that simply goes against the laws of nature. The very young should not be buried. They should not have to mourn the sudden loss of friends and loved ones. And in this case, there were two. I often wonder how the peers of children murdered by their parents process this loss. Of course, it's bad enough losing a young friend to any type of crime or accident or even illness. But how do you process the fact that the person who is in a role you have always been taught to trust and who will protect you is actually the one who killed your friend? It must be absolutely mind-blowing for a teenager to suddenly be faced with the concept that maybe your parents aren't safe after all. And if they aren't, if they can actually be the most dangerous people in your life, then who do you actually trust? If you or anyone you know has lived through something like this, please do me a favor and reach out to me if you're comfortable doing so. If you're open to it, I'd really like to hear about how children and teenagers process something like this. By February 2016, Fanny was back in court again. This stage of the legal process can be incredibly frustrating for family members, because in the pre-trial hearings, very little actually seems to be accomplished, and there are often several postponements in between. And unfortunately, this case would be no different, because the trial would only start in earnest in October 2016. By then, Fanny was accompanied by a private lawyer paid for by his friend. A plea of not guilty was entered to all three murder charges, as well as illegal possession of firearms and ammunition, and obstruction of justice. Over the next few days, all of the evidence against Fanny was presented by the state. In a stunning moment, it was revealed that police had discovered that there was a life insurance policy for Tia, which she'd taken out. It was for 2 million rand, and Fanny was a beneficiary of 50% of that, while the remaining 1 million would be split between her children in the event of her death. Because Tia had worked at the same company for so many years, she also had a sizable pension, which would pay out into her estate, which was another 1 million rand. The split was the same on that. We know that Tia was planning on divorcing Fanny, and she'd agreed to split the proceeds of their house with him. But after that, he'd be on his own. After a full adulthood of having most of his expenses paid for. If Tia died, he would get 1.5 million rand directly from her policies, and probably half the proceeds of the house. But if his children also died, he would get all of his wife's policy and pension, plus all of the proceeds of the house and anything else Tia owned. when Fani had gone around his house that morning, shooting his family. He had clearly decided that they were worth far more to him dead than alive. During the trial, Fani denied that a silencer was used at any time during the shootings. He claimed that he had made the silencer for Tia many months before so that she could use the gun for self-defense if necessary. He could not explain why anyone would need to silence a weapon if they were using it in self-defense. Fani's mother testified during the trial that she was not aware of any marital problems between her son and Tia, although she did know he'd had an affair. She would later say she didn't know what to think about the murders, because her son had never admitted to her that he'd pulled the trigger of the guns that had killed his children. By the last week of October 2016, both the defense and the state had concluded their evidence, and the judge was ready to hand down his judgment. On the 1st of November 2016, Fani Dupriya was found guilty of 3 counts of murder, 1 count of illegal possession of firearms, 1 count of illegal possession of ammunition, and 1 count of obstruction of justice. The judge saying that all the facts presented pointed to his guilt as the sole perpetrator of the crimes, and that he did not act under coercion from anyone else. In December 2016, just after the 1-year anniversary of the murders of Tia, Kalia and Philip, their husband and father, Fani Dupriya, was handed down 3 life sentences for his crimes, as well as additional years for the other charges, which would be served concurrently. During the pre-sentencing hearing, Fani's mom pleaded for him to be given a non-custodial sentence, citing her loss of 4 of her other children and saying that it was the only way she would be able to continue living. The social worker who had prepared a report about Dupriya, his crimes, its impact, and his general demeanor and behavior in prison, noted that Fani had told her that he'd joined the 28's numbers gang in prison after he was threatened, as he claimed he felt this was the only way to stay safe. 28's members are generally the most violent of incarcerated individuals who have committed some of the most heinous of crimes. So, pretty fitting, I think. In handing down the sentence, the judge said that, in his opinion, it was highly unlikely that Dupriya could be rehabilitated. He had already committed what is perhaps the most atrocious of crimes, in killing his own family. And if he had already joined a violent gang, he would likely only get worse. Tia and the children's family expressed their gratitude that the proceedings had been concluded relatively quickly, and that the most severe of sentences available had been handed down. It would do absolutely nothing to bring back the 3 innocent people he had ripped away from the world, but at least they wouldn't have to worry about him for 2.5 decades to come, and they could now start to move forward with some semblance of a new life, without Tia and the children. You'll have heard me mention earlier that Philip and Kalia had both attended Hoër Skool Driehoek in Vanderbijl Park. Their deaths had devastated that school community. And just over 3 years later, another tragedy would strike the school, which pulled Tia and the children's family back to the day their lives had changed. On the 1st of February 2019, a walkway collapsed at the school, killing 4 pupils and injuring many more. When Tia's sisters heard the news, they were once again pulled straight back to the day Tia, Kalia and Philip were killed. It felt like they were in shock all over again. While Kalia would have already matriculated by that time, Philip would have turned 18 years old in 2019 and he may well have been impacted had he still been there. Some of his cousins still attended the school, and they lost friends. The tragedy, and realizing how deeply she was still grieving, made Tia's sister Rihanna think about how she still held a lot of hatred toward Fani Dupriya, who at that time was serving his life sentences at Mangaun prison in Bloemfontein. She explained how her entire personality and way of living had changed since the murders. For the most part, she was constantly anxious that something may happen to the rest of her family. Fani's actions had been so out of the blue and so horrendous that she simply could no longer discount that even the worst of case scenarios could happen again at any moment. Rihanna told a Haskanoot journalist that after the murders, as some self-therapy, she'd started writing letters to Fani to express her pain. At first, she hadn't intended to send them. She thought that maybe one day she would burn them. But eventually she did send them off to the prison he was in at the time. She never received any response from him, she says, and she has no idea if he even got them. But that wasn't really the purpose. In writing and sending those letters, she was releasing him from her life and trying to let go of the anger and hatred she had toward him so that he would no longer have any power in her life. Then in 2022, Tia's sisters received a telephone call from someone they hadn't seen or spoken with in a long time. It was the woman with whom Fani had been having an extramarital relationship for so long while he was married to Tia, and also when he committed his crimes. The woman had some news for them that would be received with a multitude of conflicting emotions. Fani Dupriya was dead. On the 17th of November 2022, Fani suffered some sort of coronary malfunction event and passed away. Tia's sisters say that they also heard that he had some head injuries, but they weren't sure if that was caused by him perhaps falling when he had the heart attack or how those had come to be there. Very few mentions were made online about his passing, and no media reported on it at the time. I also did not find any information about there being any possible foul play in his death. For Tia's family, there were mixed feelings. While in some ways they were glad they never again had to worry about Fani Dupriya walking the streets, they also didn't feel that he had been incarcerated for long enough when he died to have truly felt the level of punishment they wanted him to experience for what he had done. Either way, Fani's death marked the true end of the tale of horror that had started at 4 a.m. in a family home in Vanderbijl Park. Or at least, the end of the physical manifestation of it. For the emotional impact, that will never end. It's felt at every family gathering, every matric farewell, every anniversary, every birthday. That can now only be marked with remembrance. Every time one of the cousins experience a milestone in their lives, it's tinged with a slight edge of sorrow that Kalia and Philip will never have theirs, and Tia will never get to see any of it. The sisters admit that Fani's death does not stop them from wondering why, because that is the one question they'll never be able to answer. Fani knew why. For him, it was probably a mix of entitlement, greed, and ego. Things we all experience at times in our lives and grapple with. But for the vast majority of us, none of those emotional experiences would ever be enough to look someone you claim to love in the eye and take their lives. But for Fani, it clearly was enough. And maybe that is the answer. Rena and Rihanna, and many of the rest of us, asking why, we'll never know the answer to that question, because we are incapable of thinking like Fani Dupriya. And maybe that is something small we should all be grateful for. Tia Dupriya, Kalia Dupriya, Philip Dupriya, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.